You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in tomorrow's super hyped boxing match, the war of words has veered into offensive language. A sports reporter tells us we should expect better from athletes in combat sports and beyond.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. On Wednesday, State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Evers announced he's running for governor in 2018. He joins a growing field of declared candidates and others getting ready to take the plunge.
Jonathan Anderson is with us for more on the 2018 governor's race and other top news from the past week. He's a reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin based in Green Bay. Jonathan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the governor's race, Jonathan, yesterday a Marquette University student filed a federal lawsuit against the university. Can you give us the story there?
Yeah, so what we know is that a former Marquette student says that she was raped by another student in 2014, and she makes a number of allegations in this federal lawsuit. One is that the university's public safety department, essentially their version of a police department, discouraged her and her parents from reporting this assault to the Milwaukee Police Department. Another claim is that university officials refused to allow police to arrest the suspect on campus. Apparently, the suspect was living across from the victim's dorm, and the woman says that she was, frightened of encountering the suspect while the case was still being investigated. And police later arrested him off campus, and he was subsequently charged with third-degree sexual assault. There were a couple of other claims, one being that the university was aware of a previous complaint involving the assailant before the rape. This one also from a female student. And it also alleges that the university retaliated against the woman by trying to force her to withdraw from the university and by putting her on academic probation.
So these are all allegations. This is going to the courts now. What do we know about when this will proceed into the courts?
Indeed, they are just allegations. And because the lawsuit was just filed yesterday, it's in a very early stage. The university will have an opportunity to file an answer, and from there it could go anywhere. We don't really know at this point how long it will take and what the final resolution will be.
Now, this happens against a backdrop of high-profile incidents like this, issues like this, at universities around the country. And meanwhile, at UW-Madison, some experts are saying that the UW-Madison sexual harassment policy could make it harder to track repeat offenders. So what are we hearing there?
Right. So the Wisconsin State Journal reported that UW-Madison does not require university supervisors or human resources officials to record any kind of anonymous complaints about sexual harassment that students or even employees may bring forward. And that could make it harder for officials to know if an employee has been previously disciplined for sexual harassment. And it also could lead to lawsuits from victims of sexual harassment. And the idea there is that the university could be liable if it had knowledge of an employee's bad behavior but didn't take action to address it.
And what's been the response from UW-Madison?
Yeah, their Title IX coordinator has said that the university is working to create a system for tracking these kinds of things, and that they are trying to develop a clear process for recording complaints that are handled through what is now just an informal sort of tracking process.
Talking to Jonathan Anderson from USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Green Bay, looking at some of the top Wisconsin news stories of the week. Let's turn now to that governor's race. Democrats trying to find someone to run against Governor Walker in next year's election for governor. State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Evers officially in the race now. What do we know about the Democratic field so far?
Mm-hmm. The Democratic field is that Evers is the third Democrat to officially enter the race. Evers is running on a promise to boost funding for education. No surprise there. He's the state superintendent of public schools, and he, you know, he's also seeking to improve wages for low and middle class workers. He also made a point in his announcement this week that he's trying to, as he put it, he says, heal the state from what he says have been divisive policies from his presumptive Republican opponent, Governor Scott Walker.
And what kind of reputation does Evers have on the state level? He has won state level elections anyway, but not quite as high profile as the race for governor.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as you point out, you know, he is well regarded in education circles, and in April he did win his third reelection campaign for state superintendent by what was essentially a 2-to-1 margin, but that wasn't a partisan race, and the state superintendent is not as high profile a position, you know, as governor.
So three officially declared candidates now, but there's talk from, what, up to 8 or 9 other people about maybe entering this race. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a number of candidates who have filed paperwork with the state to sort of explore their candidacy and have these committees, but there are only a few who have filed formal declarations of candidacy.
And what have we heard from Governor Walker about his likely reelection campaign?
Yeah, likely is the word. I mean, he has essentially said that he is ready to seek another 4 years, and he has hired a campaign manager, but Walker has not yet formally filed reelection paperwork.
And then finally, this is a weird one. A dating app just released a map of the most hated foods. They broke it down by each state. What, according to this maybe limited sample, what in Wisconsin do we hate?
Yeah, according to this app called Hater, which as I learned today, seeks to match people based on the things they hate, it turns out that Wisconsinites hate Lunchables, which are those miniature meals in the plastic containers you can get in a grocery store that have, like, cheese and crackers or nachos or even the make-your-own pizzas. Apparently, we hate those the most here in the state.
Now, I've seen this. This has gotten a fair amount of play, actually. But this is a dating site I'm not familiar with. I'm not in the dating market. Maybe that's why. But a fairly narrow subset of people. Do you think this is legit? Do you think we honestly hate Lunchables in Wisconsin, Jonathan?
I mean, that's a good point that we have to question whether the data are valid, right? I'm not sure that we can apply this finding to all people, but, you know, apparently the people who really hate things have a particular distaste for Lunchables, so maybe we can just narrow the claim a bit.
Do you have strong feelings one way or the other on the Lunchable question before we let you go?
I mean, you know, 10-year-old me would probably be a big fan of Lunchables, but you know, right now, not to disparage them, but it probably wouldn't be my first choice.
Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Anderson, reporter for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Green Bay, looking at some of the biggest news and, in one case, most fun news from around Wisconsin.
Coming up, a sports reporter talks about the Mayweather-McGregor fight coming up tomorrow and tells us why we should expect better conduct from our athletes. Stay with us here on Central Time. Now, tomorrow is the day that boxing fans have been looking forward to for months. 40-year-old Floyd Mayweather, an undefeated boxer, will fight 29-year-old Conor McGregor, who is a mixed martial arts fighter.
As many fighters do in combat sports, the two have built up hype around their fight in the media, which includes some public trash talk. But most sports draw the line somewhere. So far, neither athlete has faced consequences for the often sexist, homophobic, and even racist statements they've made in press conferences.
Here's a bit of one of the few radio-appropriate exchanges we could find from a press conference last month.
How's he look now, though? His face is drooping to the left.
It feels so good to be at the top and never lose. You know what it's like to taste defeat.
Our next guest says that we should expect more from the athletes we pay money to see, including ones in combat sports.
Sarah Spain is a Chicago-based host and reporter for ESPN. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
Well, can you describe some of the language and back and forth statements that both of these, well, boxers and a sort of boxer have been making in a way that we could actually hear on the radio?
Yes, that's the tough part. You know, it's really just evolved past the usual expected trash talk. And we all, anyone who's covered or watched boxing in any capacity or MMA, understands that those pre-fight press conferences are intended to stir up this rivalry, to make you think that they really hate each other and that they're going to go out there with as much animus as possible. I mean, that's pretty much to be expected. But they really got away from the average stuff and got super deep into misogynist terms, racist, ethnic slurs, homophobia. It just became something where if they felt like their grasp of the audience or the tenor of the crowd had been lost to them, they would dive deeper and uglier. And it really stooped to a level that I think we haven't seen much of. Now, there's some historical examples of times when race has sort of been trafficked in a way to sort of spur up excitement about a fight. But I think this really devolved because of the number of press conferences in such a short time and the very obvious nature of them sort of reaching for the next thing that would incite the crowd in a way that was kind of unrelated to the fight or unrelated to a relationship that they actually have together.
And you've been comparing and contrasting, you know, if this happened in 2017 in one of the major league sports in the country, what kind of reaction do you think we'd see?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we know that most of the major professional men's sports have policies in place to protect against homophobic slurs, racist slurs. There are fines, there are suspensions, and that's within the context of competition, right? That's when they're actually playing in the heat of the moment, not some premeditated and choreographed press conference that's intended to drive publicity. So if you saw, say, Tom Brady and, you know, some opponent of his during a Super Bowl press conference using these words, it would be the biggest story in sports, and nobody would make excuses for it. So to me, it just feels as though we're allowing these athletes to be professional in the sense that they're allowed to make literally hundreds of millions of dollars for this fight and be propped up as the pillar of their sports. And then at the same time, we're making excuses for them as if they're some sort of, you know, illogical non-humans that are unable to control themselves. They are very meditated and premeditated in what they're saying. And I think we're picking and choosing when we expect to hold them to some sort of standard in ways that we never do with other sports.
So what is it about boxing that we lower, throw away our standards?
I mean, of course, a lot of it is due to the vulgarity of the sport itself, right? The violence. And because it is hand-to-hand combat, you create this sense of looking for a heel and a hero, looking for a villain. And we want to validate the barbarism of the sport itself by downgrading the quality of person that would compete in it, which I think is unfair to the athletes and also is to completely ignore that these are not the gladiators of the past who are enslaved or who are fighting for their lives. These men are going to leave this fight with hundreds of million dollars in their pocket and go back to mansions and fleets of cars and live the lifestyle that is just like all of us, or not. Well, not like all of us. I don't go home to a mansion and fleets of cars. But, you know, they are regular human beings who in these moments we then allow to suddenly be barbaric in ways that I think we really only do for this sport.
Looking at Floyd Mayweather in particular, apart from the language, he, as you're right, has had three convictions for domestic abuse against women and not really any sign of remorse or accountability after all of that. How does that factor into all of this?
Well, that's another fascinating point, is that for all they've said to each other and for all the, you know, base things that they've brought up, that has somehow been missing. And there's also a point in one of the pressers where it looks like Conor McGregor touches his head and Floyd says, "You're not allowed to touch me." And so there are these rules that are in place, right? We can fight, we can yell, we can use any slur we want. You can't bring up my domestic violence past, we can't touch each other. And that helps give you a cue that this is completely theatrical, right? And that's what makes it, I think, even worse, that this is something that they've chosen to use to promote themselves. And Floyd Mayweather, listen, to me, I think the Nevada State Gaming Commission has proven it's all about money, in that he's never once been suspended, despite being jailed and as you mentioned, convicted multiple times, despite having a record that spans now 14-plus years of abuse in various types. And those three convictions happened over several incidents, many incidents that he managed to avoid any legal issues, you know, any legal ramifications for. And he is tends to victim blame. He never takes accountability. He always says that if anything had happened, there would be pictures or video. And yet there were pictures that were mysteriously taken and disposed of by the Nevada police. So this is somebody who has managed to coast through a sport that has never really regulated his behavior outside the ring.
We're talking to Sarah Spain from ESPN about this weekend's much-hyped boxing match between Floyd Mayweather, a boxer, and Conor McGregor from the mixed martial arts world. Let's talk about this hype machine in a boxing match with one guy who doesn't box. He's not a boxer.
Yeah.
Why has this gotten such hype?
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. I think a lot of people realize that they're sort of being duped. They know it's a circus. They know it's a sham. They know it's one-sided. They can almost guarantee, unless some miracle occurs, that it's going to be an easy win for Floyd Mayweather. He's 49-0 in his career against actual boxers, right? Now he's older. He's 40 years old. He's probably lost the step. But he's still fighting a guy who's never boxed in his life. So we know it's going to be sort of a circus show, and that as much of the excitement about it is for this pre-fight prep. It's for Conor McGregor's trash talk ability and the kind of hype machine that he's created around himself. But when it gets to the fight itself, I think most agree it's going to be pretty boring, as often Mayweather's fights are. He's a tactician. He doesn't really knock people out. He's not known for the big hits. He's known for the tiny punches over time that will slowly beat them down. And he'll usually take it the length of the fight and win by decision, which isn't that exciting. Now, that might not happen with McGregor. He may leave himself wide open to a knockout because he doesn't have the strategy. But to me, it feels interesting how many are willing to plop down their money and time to watch something that has no stake. There's no belt at stake. There's no real legacy. If Mayweather loses, everyone will be able to spin it as a 40-year-old who came out of retirement for a cash grab. And if McGregor loses, everyone will say, that's what we thought all along. He was wholly unqualified. So they both enter this with really nothing to lose and hundreds of million dollars to gain. And any fan who watches is not only, I believe, complicit in supporting the base and crass sort of behavior that we've seen leading up to it, but also in directly putting money in the pockets of Floyd Mayweather. Because unlike other sports, when you buy a pay-per-view, a percentage of each of that person who pays, a percentage of their money goes straight to Floyd Mayweather, who, as you mentioned, has a sordid history of being an abuser of women.
So your recommendation for sports fans is don't view, don't pay to view, find another way to spend your sports dollars?
Yes, I will actually be taking a helicopter flight around Chicago. That is a random thing that just happens to be going on during the fight. But in the past, during Mayweather fights, I've actually gone out to dinner and then donated to a domestic violence charity instead of spending that money on the fight. Not everyone is going to do that. A lot of people don't combine their morality with their sports. I think we should care what we're being entertained by. And also, I think it's going to be incredibly boring and exactly as you expect it to be. So you can wait for it to be over, and you can watch the 10-second clip 1,000 times over and over again on YouTube and never give your money to them.
On the wider issue of what we expect from athletes in sports, we had, of course, Baltimore Ravens linebacker Ray Lewis, involved in a murder trial, a horrible incident, welcomed back in the NFL ultimately with open arms. People raved about his performance after his comeback. Kobe Bryant coming back to basketball after sexual assault allegations. There are issues in other sports. Should we be looking at those more seriously, too?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm of the opinion that the fact that, listen, sports are essentially a meritocracy. For the most part, if you can help a team, they will try to find a way to spin it to allow your return. Now, there are very extreme examples where that won't be the case, but we've seen over and over again, whether it's, domestic abuse, whether it's like Ray Lewis, who is allegedly involved in that murder, Michael Vick murdering dogs. We've seen a million examples of teams willing to welcome back players that will help the cause, and then fans who have more allegiance to their team and the team's success than they do to any sort of morality. We can continue to push for it, and I think more and more we care. You know, back in the day, the private lives and crimes of those outside the sports world were sort of left alone, even if reporters knew about them. That's not the case these days. We certainly have better policies in place for things like sexual assault, domestic violence, criminal behavior, code of conduct policies, where you have to represent the team and the league better. But the conversations need to continue because we do this across all entertainment, right? Films, music. If there are people who are deeply flawed in criminal ways, if they entertain us enough, we try to use any means necessary to spin it to welcome them back. And that's not to say that people don't deserve second chances, but as I mentioned with Floyd, if recidivism is likely because you've never expressed any desire to change, then we shouldn't accept a second chance without having proved that you desire to change. And that's, I think, the biggest step for a lot of the leagues now is requiring treatment, requiring transparency in terms of why a person might be different than the person who committed the crime that originally got them suspended or caught or whatever.
Sarah, briefly, as we wrap up, what's a fan to do if they support a team, a pro team, a college team, they want to support it, you know, to the grave, basically, they want to stick with it, and there is this bad apple, and there's this continuing, you know, excuse for bad behavior. What is a fan in that situation supposed to do?
Well, it's different for everybody. I know certainly some people just decide that they can't support the team anymore. I went through this with the Chicago Cubs when they traded for Aldis Chapman, and I think you put pressure on the team to be as transparent as possible about why they believe this person is deserving of a chance, what they're doing to ensure that recidivism won't occur, and how they're being proactive in making sure that they treat the signing of the player with respect and their fans with respect in terms of asking them to cheer for this person. I made the choice to never cheer for that specific player, but continued to cheer for my team. But I understand that each person is going to handle it differently.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Spain is a Chicago-based host and reporter for ESPN. She joined us ahead of the highly anticipated fight between Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor tomorrow and talked about whether we should expect better conduct from athletes.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about a recent review of national monuments and the conflict over federal land ownership in the western United States. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
First, months after President Trump ordered a sweeping review of national monuments in America, we're getting a first glimpse today at what possible changes might look like. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, who handled the review, gave his recommendations to the president yesterday. And while the report has yet to be made public, details are starting to come out.
The Washington Post, citing people familiar with the report, says that Zinke is recommending changes to at least three national monuments established by recent presidents, including Bears Ears in Utah, which could potentially be looking at a significant reduction in protected acres. In addition, land that's freed from federal protection could potentially be opened up to new mining or drilling. But before anything can happen, the president would have to take action on the recommendations.
For more on this and the conflict over federal land ownership, especially out west, we turn to John Ruppel. He's an associate professor of law and a fellow at the Wallace Stegner Center for Land Resources and the Environment at the University of Utah. John, thanks a lot for being here today.
Hi, Veronica. Thank you for having me.
Well, John, as we said, this report, it isn't public, but some of the details are starting to trickle out. What do we know so far about these recommendations on national monuments?
We don't know a whole lot at this point. What we can say for sure is that President Trump issued an executive order directing the secretary to review 27 national monuments to make some determinations about their future, that Secretary Zinke issued a preliminary report several months ago saying that he thought Bears Ears should be reduced, and that a draft of the final report has been transmitted to the White House. But as you say, we haven't seen the content of that report. We don't know precisely what the secretary recommends, what monuments are in play, or what the president will do in the end.
Now, we should be clear about what exactly a national monument is. It might bring to mind the Washington Monument in D.C., but we're talking about something pretty different here. Can we start with the basics? What is a national monument?
It's a great question. Let's try and distinguish him from a national park. That may help. If you think about a national park like Yellowstone or Yosemite, those are set aside by Congress to protect those resources within the park boundary and to facilitate visitation and really preserve the resources unimpaired in light of that visitation. A national monument's quite a bit different. It can be set aside by Congress, but the majority of them are set aside by the president through a presidential proclamation. And at least over the last 20-plus years, a lot of those monuments, the landscape-scale monuments, I should say, it's quite common for a president to set aside a small monument, like the Washington Monument or more discrete sites, but they can also set aside very large monuments. And in the West, that's where things become controversial. For those larger Western monuments, at least since 1996 or so, they've been more likely to be working monuments. So in the case of Bears Ears or the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument here, both of those allow livestock grazing within the National Monument. They allow basically free access. They have roads passing through them. They're easily accessible. Hunting occurs within those monuments. It continues to be regulated by the state. So they're more of a working monument as distinct from a national park.
And what if a private interest had interest in doing something on the land, leasing it, doing something like drilling for oil? Would that be allowed at a national monument?
It depends. The proclamations apply only to federal land, so if there are private inholdings within any of those monuments, that inholding owner would be able to move forward as they had before, as if nothing had changed. If somebody had an existing lease or an existing mining claim within the monument, those valid existing rights are already protected and grandfathered in as well. So those uses could conceivably continue. What most proclamations do is they withdraw those lands from availability for future oil and gas leasing or future mineral development. So it would have a prospective effect that would eliminate that kind of development. But to the extent that leases have already been entered into, those would be recognized.
So to back up a little bit and get some context here, President Trump had ordered Secretary Zinke to look at 27 sites established by previous presidents under something called the Antiquities Act of 1906, and that becomes important as we look at the debate over land use and national monuments today. So can we talk a little bit about what the Antiquities Act is and what it does?
Sure, and I think we need to start a little bit with the U.S. Constitution. The Property Clause of the Constitution grants power over public lands to Congress, and it's a largely exclusive grant. So before the president gets to act with respect to public lands, Congress has to delegate some authority over those lands to the president. And that's what they did back in 1906 when they passed the Antiquities Act. Essentially, you had two different competing bills that had been working through Congress for a couple of years. One bill focused on larger kind of landscape protection. The other bill focused on smaller sites and protection of, you know, what you might think of as an Anasazi cliff dwelling or something of the sort. The compromise allowed the president to set aside national monuments, and it set up two criteria for that. The first being that the area had to contain objects of historic or scientific interest, and the other was that the area had to be the smallest area compatible with the proper care and management of those resources. And both of those determinations were essentially left to the president's discretion. So the Antiquities Act allows the president to create national monuments, to set them aside anytime he feels that there are objects of historic or scientific importance that merit protection. What the Antiquities Act doesn't talk about is the power to rescind or revoke or modify a national monument proclamation. And that's where we're starting to run into a lot of debate. Clearly, there's the possibility that President Trump will issue an order changing those boundaries, and then we'll end up in a debate over whether he can do that.
We're talking right now with John Rubel from the from the University of Utah about the recent review of national monuments and the conflict over federal land ownership, especially in the western United States, where many of these monuments that seem likely to be under consideration are located, and looking then at the powers of the president and what he could do under the Antiquities Act. Where are the fault lines there? What's the controversy over the president's powers and what he may or may not be able to do with these national monuments?
Yeah, like I say, the Antiquities Act gives the president the power to set aside national monuments. It says nothing about the power to reduce or eliminate those. And that's where the conflict arises. One argument is that had Congress intended to give the president that power, they would have said so explicitly. There were a number of other statutes that Congress had passed that allowed the president to set aside federal lands for various uses, and many of those did, in fact, give the president the power to change or modify those reservations. So if Congress had meant to do it in the Antiquities Act, they would have done it here. They didn't. That seems to imply congressional intent. So the counterargument largely is that presidents over the years, over the last 111 years, have acted on a number of occasions to revise national monuments. The last revision was 56 years ago by President Kennedy. But the argument is that those prior reductions and congressional acquiescence in those implies that Congress was okay with the president having that power. Now, the first point to make is none of those prior reductions were challenged in court, so we don't have any definitive case law on that issue. But it's a bit challenging, one, because in 1976, Congress passed the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, and that statute specifically looked at reshaping that balance of power between Congress and the president with respect to public lands. And Congress exerted more control in that area. So there's a strong argument to be made that even if there was an implicit power, it has since been eliminated by Congress. And the other argument, I think, that's out there is that these prior reductions are very, very different in terms of scope and context. Never before have we seen this review of 27 national monuments based on what appear to be largely political concerns. The prior reductions were all driven by very site-specific issues with individual monuments. The majority of those probably involve things that I would lump together as mapping corrections and corrections of errors in the original proclamation as opposed to politically driven considerations. There's also a large class of monuments that were reduced for reasons having to do with national security, so building airports for airfields for military aircraft or providing raw materials to support the war effort during World War I. So they're very different than what we're talking about today.
We're talking right now with John Rupel from the University of Utah about the recent review of national monuments and the conflict over federal land ownership, especially in the western United States. Changes could be coming to some of these national monuments, and we're finding out what that could look like.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of this review of national monuments? Do you agree with the president when he says that states should have more say in how public lands are used? Are you worried about what this could mean for conservation? Do you think the federal government owns too much land, especially in the western United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in a little bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with John Rupel of the University of Utah, looking at public lands, national monuments, and the Trump administration. A recent review of national monuments suggests that changes could be coming for some protected lands out west. We're learning more about what that can mean and why this is such a hot button issue.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What role do you think the federal government should play when it comes to protecting lands? Would you support a rollback of some protections for some national monuments? And what questions do you have? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And John, looking at the large concentration of these national monuments in the American West, including Bears Ears in Utah, where you are, and this is a much more contentious issue in some parts of the country. Can you walk us through who's on the different sides of this debate and then what they have to say?
Sure. I think one of the things that makes Bears Ears very unique is that it was a monument that was set aside after five Native American tribes came together and petitioned the president to do this. So it's unprecedented in that respect. So you had the Navajo Nation, the Hopis, the Ute Indian Tribe, the Ute Mountain Ute Indian Tribe, and the Zunis coming together and asking for this monument and a role in really protecting their heritage in this landscape. And I should say they were also supported by 25 additional supporting tribes. So that makes it unique in that regard. When you look at the landscape itself, what the Congressionally Chartered National Trust for Historic Preservation has said is that nowhere else in the United States are there so many well-preserved cultural resources found within what they described as a striking and relatively undeveloped natural landscape. So it's a very special landscape. When you look at it, the estimates are that it contains over 100,000 archaeological sites reflecting over 11,000 years of Native American history and use. So it's a really special place. It's a place that is becoming increasingly known and increasingly visited. So we're seeing impacts from pot hunting and looting of archaeological sites. We're seeing impacts from just the sheer increase in visitation and people starting to love this area to death. So there's a real importance to it, and those are the issues that I think are driving its protection. On the other side, about two-thirds of the land in the state of Utah is federally owned. So while the new national monument doesn't increase federal land ownership, it does change the lens through which land managers view this landscape. So it means likely more protective management, and locals in rural parts of the state often associate that with less opportunity to develop commodity-type resources, so more difficulty in drilling for oil or gas or for mining for uranium or timber production or potentially running livestock on this landscape. But as we said, to the extent that those rights are already in place, those valid rights are protected. But there's still this tension, this concern that there is a lot of federal land out here. How the federal government goes about managing it impacts local communities, and people in rural parts of the state are really concerned about that.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Adam joining us from Green Bay. Adam, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to ask?
Well, you know, I just got done with work. I just jumped in the car, kind of heard, you know, the conversation about, you know, government control of federal lands, you know, out west. But just in general, you know, my concern is that, you know, eventually, you know, these lands will become privatized. You know, if we hand them over to private interests, or if we just let them go, we're never going to give them back. And once they're gone, they're gone. And, you know, we live in a capitalistic society where, you know, if you know, people are going to be looking to make money off those, and that means that certain demographics of people aren't going to have access to them, and you know, national parks or parks in general, or you know, those lands that are ran by the government, you know, those parks were meant to be accessed by, you know, everyone.
Adam, thanks a lot. Got your comment there, and I want to know what you think about that, John. There are some environmental groups who are thinking along the same lines as Adam, are concerned that this would amount to handing over what is now federal land to oil drilling, for instance, to private interests.
Yeah, well, thanks, Adam. I appreciate your call. First, to echo a point he made, these lands our public lands belong to all Americans. So they're not owned uniquely or disproportionately by residents of Utah or these rural communities where these national monuments occur. So everybody has a right, everybody should have a voice in their management. Now, I want to, Adam mentioned that this notion of these lands might be sold. That's not necessarily, I think, going to happen pursuant to this review. There is a separate independent push by some states and some local groups to try and obtain title to public lands in the West, but I think that needs to be set aside from the current monument review. But to the point I think Adam was making is that even if these lands aren't sold, if you have a long-term lease that allows for energy development on that landscape and you start seeing oil wells or natural gas wells proliferating, you start seeing pipelines and other infrastructure needed to support that, that question of ownership starts to become kind of academic. The reality on the ground, as somebody that might want to visit that landscape, might want to recreate, might want to view it, it's very different regardless of who owns it.
Adam, thanks for that. And we'll go to another caller now. We've got Eric next in Lancaster. Eric, hi.
Hi. I'm just finishing a book on the life of John Muir, and a lot of the things we're talking about there were things that John Muir fought so hard for to conserve the land and the resources and the water and the trees in our forests and stuff, and he worked with Teddy Roosevelt on trying to get land set aside, and Teddy Roosevelt spoke to Congress on trying to get some land set aside, and he said that land should be set aside forever for the use and benefits of our people as a whole and not sacrificed to the short-sighted greed of a few.
Eric, thanks a lot for that comment. And John, is there a concern that that sort of land ethic that might underpin some of the creation of these national monuments could be at stake here?
Absolutely. That's the heart of the argument coming from the environmental community, is that these lands were set aside because they are truly special, because they're unique. And the minute we remove them from our national conservation land system, that there's a risk that something is lost. We'll have to wait and see what the president chooses to do. We'll have to wait and see if there are changes recommended or made with respect to management of these lands. But if they're open to energy development, that could definitely impact the nature of the resource.
And thanks a lot for that call, Eric. Appreciate it. And John, this report is in the hands of the president. What do you expect is going to happen next?
It's really difficult to say. We're anxious to see the report. We're anxious to see the recommendations that Secretary Zinke made, and we're anxious to see what the president chooses to do with that. He has a number of options. He could leave monuments as they are. He could choose to rescind or revoke designations or change management prescriptions. That almost certainly will lead to litigation. He could also say, look, there are some legitimate concerns being voiced by Western states and rural communities that we need to think more carefully about how rural communities are impacted by designations. We need to think about the economic impacts of monuments. And I think a very good argument can be made is that discussion needs to happen in the halls of Congress, where we can think comprehensively about what our vision for our public lands is, the trade-offs that we're willing to accept in terms of conservation versus commodity development and economic development. So there's the possibility that these questions could go to Congress, but we'll have to wait and see if the president chooses to follow that route.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Veronica.
John Ruppel is an associate professor of law and a fellow at the Wallace Stegner Center for Land Resources and the Environment at the University of Utah, joining us to talk about possible changes coming to some national monuments.